The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening. And this evening I will continue with a series of talks I started last week on the five hindrances. For those of you who weren't here last week, I introduced the five hindrances. The five hindrances are five activities or qualities of mind which hinder us. And so if we have a purpose, or if we want to be wise, or if we want to be clear or mindful, or if we want to be concentrated still, there are various things that can hinder that possibility, make it difficult. And so it's looking at these hindering activities. And it turns out that for people doing mindfulness practice, it's really helpful to study these activities, these qualities of mind. So the five hindrances are, the narrow description of them, they are a sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and doubt. And desire, or sensual desire, is only a hindrance if it hinders. If it doesn't hinder you, if it doesn't hinder wisdom, clarity, stability, concentration, or doesn't hinder what you want to do with your life, what you're about, then it's not a hindrance. In fact, sometimes these things maybe can even be supportive, perhaps. But all too often, they can be hindrances. And in meditation practice in particular, these can be very powerful forces that can make it very hard for us to get settled and for meditation practice to unfold. So for mindfulness students, it's very important to study these and get to know them well so that they lose their power to hinder. Often people's attitude towards them is that they shouldn't be there, they're unfortunate, and people like to get over them very quickly. And I'd like to encourage you, even if you feel troubled by them or hindered by them, don't get over them quickly. Rather, get to know them well, study them, understand the various aspects of them, and then with that deeper understanding, there can be greater freedom. And it turns out that a lot of people who come to meditation practice are relating to meditation as if meditation is about having some kind of experience, some kind of deep experience or blissful experience or calm experience, some kind of experience. And certainly experience is part of it, but classically in Buddhism, experience is less important than understanding. And even when people have a so-called experience of awakening, the Buddha always followed that with understanding. One understands what that's about. Understanding is very important. So we train ourselves to begin to understand better and better what's happening in our life, in our experience. And so we try to understand these hindrances. So today, the topic is the first hindrance of sense desires, sensual desire. Some people quite happily expand this outward to include all desire, because just about any desire can be hindering if we're preoccupied by it, if we're caught up in it. We can be blinded by almost any desire at all. So some people like to expand it outward. The Buddha limited it to sensual desire. When I was 20 or so, 21, I was hitchhiking in Denmark. And this Dane picked me up and we were talking about stuff, and he asked me what I wanted to do with my life or what I wanted to do with something, and I said, oh, I wanted to study Buddhism, I wanted to study Sufism, I wanted to study Gestalt therapy, I wanted to get involved in rolfing, I wanted to learn farming, I wanted to learn woodworking and carpentry, and I probably had other things I wanted to do. And at some point, he turned to me and said something that was kind of a wake-up for me. He said to me, "You have a lot of desires." And it hadn't occurred to me that I had not only a lot of desires, but maybe the list of desires I had were just, you know, not enough, you know, too much for one lifetime even, all these things I wanted to do. And so I started then from there on, to some degree, began to look at this nature of desire and how it functioned in my life. And I saw that there are plenty of times when desire is quite limiting and has a negative cost. And there are sometimes the desire is quite freeing and helpful to have desires. Buddhism itself is not anti-desire. Desire is this very broad umbrella term for a wish. And you can wish for beautiful things, beautiful aspirations. You can desire awakening, you can desire to have greater compassion, you can desire well-being for your family, your neighbors, your world. There's a lot of beautiful desires to live through and act on. But there's also a lot of desires which can cause harm to others, cause harm to oneself. And even when they're not obviously causing harm, to be caught in the grip of desire has its cost. And so, for example, I used to, when I was also young, I used to love going to bookstores because I just like books. And I didn't have any money back then, and so I wouldn't buy any books. I would just look at all the books that I, you know, just look at all the books. And I noticed after a while I'd leave the bookstores exhausted. And what's that about? What's going on? So I looked into that a little bit, and I discovered that when I was in bookstores, I wanted half the titles I saw. And that wanting, you know, just all wanting, you know, for half an hour or an hour, however long is the bookstore, that constant wanting of stuff was exhausting. So wanting can be exhausting. In Buddhism, they have a teaching that desire, especially sensual desire, any desire, has a function of hiding or camouflaging suffering. So sometimes if we're feeling suffering, one strategy to dealing with suffering is to want something out there, to fix it or to take care of it, make it better, or to distract us from it. And sometimes the allure of pleasure, the allure of some wonderful desire, can be so infatuating. We can get pulled into the fantasy of that. And we can get pulled into the pursuit of some desire that we don't notice that we're running away from some discomfort in ourselves, some suffering. And we also might not notice that the very pursuit of the desire itself is uncomfortable. Isn't that something? So, because we're so kind of enamored with that thing that we want to have. So, for example, it comes to mind, maybe it's not the best example, but all kinds of examples come to mind. Now that I think about it. Both examples had to do with when I was 14 years old, chasing girls. And pursuing girls, I guess, you know, has a certain kind of desire, some, hopefully a nice outcome. And I remember once trying to impress her by trying to smoke a cigarette, which I don't find a very pleasant thing to do. And I also didn't know how to light a cigarette. So I didn't succeed. I didn't know you're supposed to keep in your mouth when you puff in. I just started trying to. So that was a rather unpleasant, you know, attempt to pursue something pleasant. Or then on the same time, meeting a girl, following her home to where she lived on her street, and all I knew was her first name and the street she lived on. But I wanted to, you know, somehow connect with her again. So my friend and I, one of us went from the front of the phone book and the other one went from the back of the phone book, and we called everyone who lived on that street asking for her. So I'm sure none of you have been that, you know, fanatical about pursuing desires. But it happens to some of us. And But anyway, sometimes the pursuit of desire can mask, can hide the suffering from us, and also sometimes the very suffering in pursuing it. Sometimes the pursuit of desire can be alienating. We kind of lose touch with ourselves, kind of this kind of hiding suffering. Partly because we're so focused on the object of what we want, that we don't really notice what's going on here with us. We don't necessarily notice that the wanting that we have comes from maybe loneliness, or comes from fear, or comes from some sense of emptiness, or who knows what, something here. And so we're pursuing the object. Or we might not notice that the desire, the way we're holding the desire, seems like a wonderful, nice, pleasant thing to want, whatever it might be. We don't realize, perhaps, that there's greed, lust, something very powerful and very painful, kind of, addiction sometimes that we're in the grips of. We don't notice, perhaps, that we've lost our freedom in the pursuit of it. We think we're free because we're freely pursuing it, going after it. But in fact, you'd find out very quickly how unfree you were if you tried to stop the pursuit. And then these very powerful surges of energy and movement and thoughts and everything, kind of like, oh, you got to get it. People who have any kind of addiction or close to an addiction issue, I certainly, I think, have felt that very powerful force within us that we've got to have it. So there's kind of a losing touch with ourselves in the process sometimes of being blinded by the wonderfulness of this desire that we want. Desire is such a big part of human life that I think that rather than calling people human beings, they should be called human desirelings. It's such a big thing. So, and whatever your philosophy might be around desire, some people are quick to justify it, some people are quick to condemn it, whatever it might be, because it's such a big part of human experience, it's really good to study it, get to know it. And what does it feel like? What does it feel like within us, around us? What's the effects of it? So one of the things we do then is we study it. Now there are maybe three or four different ways that we work with desire in meditation. One is that when we find ourselves derailed from our meditation, we're trying to stay with the breath, trying to stay in the present moment, and the mind gets pulled into thoughts about desire, what we want, and kind of thinking and fantasizing and into what we want. One way to deal with it is to redouble our commitment or effort to stay with meditation. And sometimes we wander away too easily because we're not really... we haven't really kind of firmed up our intention or motivation, just kind of really to apply ourselves. So sometimes we need to apply ourselves more strongly. Another way is to study what it is we're desiring. What do you want? What is it, the thing you want? And is it really cut out to be what you think it is? Is it really that desirable? Or what are the disadvantages of the thing that you're desiring? It can be very unpopular to tell someone, you should spend some time looking at the undesirable aspects of what you desire, the disagreeable aspects of what you desire, because, what you desire is what you want. But there's a long tradition in Buddhism of spending, if you're really caught as a hindrance, caught in desire, not free from your desires, then there's a whole practice of reflecting about what is it that you're desiring, and is it really that desirable? Or can you think, look at it in different angles? And so to kind of free yourself up from that. And there's a lot of reflections that can lead to this. One of them is sensual pleasure, wanting sensual pleasure, that sensual pleasure is always temporary. And so the temporary nature of it, the fleeting nature of it, maybe is not warrant the tremendous pursuit of it, all the effort we put into it. Perhaps there are better forms of well-being, of happiness, that can be pursued with that much energy and vigor that are different from the kind of pleasures that come from the senses. There can be reflections on, you know, they have this classic one in Buddhism, which is very unpopular, and that is if you find yourself fantasizing sexually about someone, you try to imagine the unappetizing parts of their body. And, or, you know, imagine, you know, like their bodies split open and, you know, and the feces is bubbling up and the pus and saliva and snot. Now, you know, it's not something you would normally want to do, but, you know, I've known in my experience there are times when when I was younger, you know, the grip that sexual lust had on me was quite powerful and quite inappropriate and quite detrimental to myself and detrimental to others if I'd acted on it. But I was kind of sometimes caught in that grip. And if I'd known about this Buddhist practice of, you know, imagining the pus and the urine and blood and bile and, you know, it might have helped. And it might have been a good thing to have done in that circumstance. You don't do that on your honeymoon. You know, or so, you know, at times you don't do it, of course. We're talking about the desire which are hindering. So anyway, to look at the disadvantages of getting what you want. There's a whole reflection of that. So the first is redouble your efforts on meditation. The second is to look at the disadvantages or even the dangers of what it is you want. So sometimes I think it's a very maturing process, thinking about the disadvantages or the dangers. Many times we think that there's no dangers, or we think, oh, no one will notice. I'll get away with that one. But actually it can be very damaging to many, many people to pursue certain desires that people chase after. Then the third way of dealing with desires is to look at it more deeply and to look and see what is it that's actually underneath the desire. Is there something that motivates it or fuels it or is a catalyst for it? What's the cause for it? What are the variety of conditions that bring it about? So as I've said earlier, you know, so loneliness can be a catalyst for some desires. Discomfort can be a strong motivator for desires. Now, you can think it's, you know, reasonable to become comfortable if you're uncomfortable, but sometimes people attempt to escape uncomfortable situations can take extreme forms. And so, you know, alcohol, for example, or getting lost in sex or getting lost in all kinds of things is a way of avoiding some real world issue that you better enter into and look at more deeply rather than ignoring. It can be that we distract ourselves from rather than going and looking deeply. There can be a very deep, I like it that the word English word wanting has a kind of double meaning. It has the meaning, you know, you want something. I was wanting something. But also we say the soup was wanting salt. And I guess it kind of implies that the soup desires salt. But what it means is that the soup is lacking salt, doesn't have enough salt. And so sometimes it's a sense of lack. How is it that there's a sense of lack that might be there in the pursuit of some kind of desire? And I think addiction often has that quality, that there's some kind of discomfort, some kind of lack, some kind of something. That's very much the catalyst, and a misdirected attempt to try to satisfy something that can actually never get satisfied by the object of that desire and addiction, but it temporarily soothes it over, gives relief to something. So what are the conditions? And so there's conditions inside of us, but there's also conditions in the world around us. And I think it's a very useful at times to look and see are we allowing ourselves to be conditioned by the environment around us in such a way to fuel our tendency, our habit for certain desires. I've seen it in myself that if I kind of go after certain desires, you know, want certain things, then I tend to want it, you know, more of it. So it's very common for some people, maybe everyone perhaps, who do it. pornography. That pornography can set up, you know, can, you know, there's some certain pleasure, I guess, that's why people do it. But then the mind is filled with those pictures. And those filled with those pictures, and then there's more desire, more kind of emptiness, and kind of, you know, one little contact with pornography can lead to a lot of, you know, desire. It goes on and on. Or looking at magazines, certain kind of advertisements, or certain kind of media can stimulate desires. Spend too much time looking at fashion magazines or car magazines. Look at that beautiful car, you know. And you start after looking at that car, you find yourself having the next day desires for cars. So, letting us receive a certain kind of input can be a condition for our mind spinning out. So a wise approach then would be to realize that and say, you know, I think I need to limit what I'm looking at, what I'm taking in. Maybe I don't look at car magazines. Maybe I don't do this and that because, you know, I'm so susceptible to it. It seems to be almost a biological thing that goes on inside my brain where it kind of takes over and I'm not so free anymore. So then making some behavioral changes around the input we get can have an impact on how much we're caught in the grip of desire. Now the fourth desire, the fourth way of working with desire, and this has particularly true with sensual desire, sense desire. So as I said earlier, this hindrance in the Buddha's teaching is particularly the hindrance of sensual desire for sensual pleasure, which might seem initially kind of a lightweight kind of thing, but it doesn't take a lot of reflection to realize the tremendous grip and power that sensual desire has on human beings. Just simply to remind us that sensual desire includes sexual desire, and we realize that it can cause a tremendous amount of slavery in people's minds, in people's, you know, for people who, you know, are caught by it, a lot of suffering in the world. People will make a lot of poor choices around wanting more desire, wanting more pleasure, for example, in sexuality. There's a whole litany, a whole list of terrible, painful things that people do to each other because of wanting better pleasure. To mention just one that's often mentioned, I think, often enough, is sometimes men refusing to wear condoms because it decreases their pleasure. Well, so then AIDS is spread, or the pregnancies happen. And the whole thing was because it had to do with a degree of pleasure, and you know, that degree of pleasure, wanting greater pleasure, made some very poor choices. There's sensual desire around sense desire around food. There's sense desire around comfort, physical contact. There's sense desire around hearing, smelling, all kinds of things can be sense contact. Even in Buddhist language, there's also a kind of sense pleasure that comes in the mind. When the mind feels pleasure from, for example, working puzzles can be very pleasant for some people. It creates kind of mental pleasure. Working out problems. Fantasizing can create a kind of a mental kind of pleasure, mental, physical kind of pleasure. And some people are addicted to or really pulled into the pleasure that can come from the mind as much as the pleasure can come from the body. So in terms of sensual pleasure, the fourth way of working with this is very interesting, I think. And this comes directly from the Buddha. Is to experience or to develop or cultivate a stronger pleasure or sense of well-being or happiness, joy, that's not sensual. So rather than doing away with it, rather than trying to repress it or deny it or work through it and find a way to get free of it, directly, you shed it like a snake sheds its skin because you have something so much better. It's like, you know, you like these dry wasa crackers. They're good for what they are. And you've happily eating them for a long time. And then someone comes along with a cream puff. And then it's easy to let go of the wasa crackers because you have this, the cream puff is so sweet and, well, you know, wow. And so, you know. And so it's interesting. So people often associate sometimes Buddhism with renunciation, which means, oh, you have to just let go of all this stuff. And here Gil's talking about sensual pleasures and letting go of it. And this Buddhism stuff is just such a world-negating, life-denying kind of thing. Boy, what a party pooper. But in fact, the Buddha encouraged, said one of the ways to overcome sensual pleasure, and in fact, not only say one of the ways, he said some of the most tenacious forms of sensual pleasure, like sexual desire and all that, it's very difficult to uproot or become free of unless you cultivate a sense of well-being, sense of happiness or pleasure that's greater than the pleasure that comes from even sexuality. And so generally in Buddhist circles and teachings of the Buddha, that comes from meditation. And so to cultivate states of joy and rapture and bliss, well-being, that is not dependent on any of the senses being stimulated. So that's quite something. So none of the senses are being stimulated. It's being created. It's causes and conditions bring it about, but they arise out of concentration and stillness and mental stability. When the mind gets unified and settled on itself, when the mind is not fragmented, going this way and that way, when the mind is not chasing after desires and objects of desires, not trying to defend itself, not kind of caught up in the worldly object of things, and gets settled and discovers some degree of being unified and peaceful, then it can be a welling up, and the expression is welling up, like a spring that wells up from the bottom of a lake, kind of beautiful, refreshing spring that wells up. There can be a welling up of a deep sense of well-being that's so much more satisfying than even sexual pleasure. That, you know, why would you bother with the wasa cracker? It's not criticizing wasa crackers. They're good for what they are, but you have something really better. Now, this doesn't mean, for example, that we dwell in some kind of bliss state all the time and not do normal human things and enjoy normal human sensual pleasures and pursuits. But if we want to be freed of slavery by those things, being trapped by them, we want to be not limited by those, not caught in their grip, not hindered by them, it really helps to know there's something better. And then when you sit and meditate and you start having fantasies about this and that and this desire and that, all you need to do is remind yourself, wait a minute, this isn't really what it's cut out to be. This isn't really so great. I think there's something a lot better. And so then you're more willing to kind of continue with the meditation, not be derailed by these fantasies and ideas and desires, what we want, and allow us to settle in, really start connecting more deeply to our living experience, our direct experience of meditation here and now. And then with time, this greater sense of well-being can arise. And I think it's really a phenomenal thing to discover a sense of inner well-being that's not dependent on anything in the world being one way or the other. So, you know, if you pursue sensual pleasures, then the world has to provide it somehow or other. And it does, sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. And a lot of things, you know, if you want, your happiness is dependent on your investments, then sometimes you're lucky and nowadays you're not. And so then your happiness goes up and down with the stock market. Or if, you know, it's all kinds of things, which if you're investing your happiness in the world of things, it's a little bit fragile. But to discover a kind of deep well-being that wells up from within, that exists independent of what happens to the stock market or what happens to the weather or what happens to your date or whatever is going on, provides can provide a sense of freedom and power over a sense of power to be able to choose not to pursue, not be caught by the worldly concerns. And if you have the power to choose not to be caught by them, then you could also choose when to pursue them, when it's appropriate. It's not denying that those things are appropriate at times, it's okay to do it. But to discover an inner well-being that's independent of the conditions of the world is really liberating. Then you can't take it with you anywhere. And then the ups and downs of the world are not going to influence you as much. So the pursuit of sensual desire should be that should be studied, should be understood. We understand what the fulfillment of the dangers and the fulfillment of the desire, of sensual desire, the disadvantages that can be there. We understand where it comes from inside of us, the conditions inside of us. And hopefully with time, we learn to cultivate a place inside, a home inside, a well-being inside, a joy inside, that then we carry with us and makes it easy not to pick up all the temptations that come our way. And what's really beautiful about this deep welling up of well-being inside is that it might sound initially kind of selfish, you know, to have this well-being for yourself. But that the welling up of deep kind of well-being from inside is not dependent on the conditions of the world is the seems to be very closely connected or intimately connected with our capacity for empathy and compassion. So it doesn't become something we do just for ourselves, but actually allows some of the most beautiful qualities of human connectedness to flow from that sense of inner happiness and well-being. So we use mindfulness. Mindfulness is a powerful tool to set you free from sensual desire, if you want. And if you don't want to become free of sensual desire, then probably mindfulness is not your practice. Because if you're not free of sensual desire, or if you at least kind of want that freedom from it, then there's no mindfulness possible. Mindfulness is the very act of being mindful is the act of setting yourself free from the forces in the mind that keep you in its grips. So we have about 7 minutes, and now it's your turn for comments, protests, and questions. Yes, please. Pass it back. Rush right back by the...
Unless I missed something, I heard the focus on sensual desire. What if it's not sensual desire? What if it's desire for something non-sensual and you can't come up with disadvantages of having what you want? You can't think of the negative, undesirable, whatever consequences of having what you want. So how do you tame that? But and also...
Well, it's a little bit abstract, so I don't know if I might miss you if I answer, because I don't know what you're talking about. But the sometimes there are reasonable desires to have. People are hungry, and wanting food is a good thing. And so that's a reasonable... We don't want to take that away from someone who's hungry. But if food is not available, if not possible, then spending a lot of time pursuing it when it's not around is a waste of time. And maybe the time is spent better doing something else. So sometimes it takes some worldly consideration. You know, I want something, it's not really available, I can't really do it, so I'm really spinning my wheels if I keep wanting something that's not going to come my way. And some people, like especially like in relationships, can spin their wheels a lot. They keep wanting that person, for something from that person. They want something from that person. It's a whole range of things they might want. That person might be, it might be impossible for that person to provide it, or the person might be completely unwilling. And no matter how much we bang on the door, it's never going to happen. So then it requires seeing that and really knowing this is an impossible situation. So it really it's going to hurt me. It's a disadvantage for me to pursue this because I'm just wasting my life. I'm wasting my energy. And so then, rather than disadvantage of the object, what we want, we might look at the disadvantage of the pursuit.
And also, how do you go about developing that ideal state of inner well-being, happiness coming from inside and not depending on any external whatever out there? How do you develop that?
Well, meditation practice in our tradition, that's one of the primary ways of doing that. And in meditation practice where we learn to really be in the present moment, focused and concentrated, without the mind going that this way and that way into the future, the past, into desire or aversion, but just able to stay centered, balanced, and peaceful with this particular moment here. That's the path.
It's really important. Actually, I'll just make a comment as if I knew what I was talking about. It's real important to make sure that we're not just being, anti-life. I mean, I know this is something that's been which has been given to, talked about in terms of Buddhism, but... And that we see desire as simply a part of being human. It is part of us. We do have desires. It's only when we become fixated on those desires, we become compulsive thinking about them. And usually a good indication is when you are meditating and you compulsively go to a thought. That's just an indication how unfree we are. And so it's not, any particular thing. Even, you can take, the desire to be successful in your work. That's actually a good thing. But if you, if you now measure yourself against your success in work, then that's unfree. It's, it can be compulsive. It can be, so.
Beautiful. I completely agree with what you're saying.
Yeah.
And there's healthy desires and there are unhealthy desires.
Yeah.
But even healthy desires are unhealthy if there's compulsion.
Yeah.
And so what I encourage people to do is to notice if there's compulsion, because then you're not free. And there's suffering. There's suffering is in that situation. So just because something looks healthy on the surface, how we hold that healthy desire might not be healthy.
Right.
And so we want to tease that apart. And the more we tease this apart, the more I think we have a beautiful, clean ability to pursue healthy desires, appropriate desires. And also, if we don't have compulsion as part of it, then we're less likely to suffer from excessive frustration when we don't succeed in our desire.
Yes.
if we get really disappointed, deeply disappointed and frustrated and angry when what we're pursuing doesn't occur, even though it was a healthy desire, then probably the way we were holding it was a little bit off.
Yeah, it's important to remember we're all once a gleam in our father's eyes, or I.
And our mother's too.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah, so desire itself isn't necessarily the problem. It's how we, as you say, hold it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Last one here.
Yeah, I just wanted to continue on this discussion. I mean, I know that, as you said, that desire itself can be healthy, but it's the compulsion that is incorrect, perhaps. But I think that sometimes it is compulsion that drives us to the greatest heights of human achievement. You know, beautiful art, music, that all is created out of compulsion, you know. And I think that in some ways, we human beings, the whole world evolves out of compulsion. I mean, the first fish, when it crawled out of water onto the land, it did it out of compulsion, and it did not do it because, you know, it was sitting at the bottom of the ocean and it had this deep, you know, wellspring that was coming from within. I mean, I'm not trying to say that we should blindly follow our compulsions either. And I think that is where meditation practice is very important.
Right.
That we sit down and we try to understand what is our compulsion, what are the desires that we have, and you know, whether we are following those desires in a mindful manner. But I think it would be incorrect to just, you know, say compulsions are not important.
So you want to justify compulsion because the result of compulsion are some of the great human accomplishments.
Yes.
That end justifies the means for you. Even though the means has suffering as part of it. Compulsion has suffering. When there's compulsion, there's suffering, there's tension as part of it. So you want to justify the end by the means. So that's one thing. The other is that there are other motivating forces for human beings besides compulsion, and there are motivating forces that can produce fantastic things as well. And so, for example, I like to call them aspirations rather than compulsions, vision rather than compulsion. And I think there are plenty of examples of people who followed a vision or an aspiration without a compulsion, but with tremendous dedication and purpose and commitment, and accomplished great things. It's not what you said, but it relates to it. There are people who want to justify anger for that reason as well. Because I'm angry, I can accomplish a lot of things. I can fight for justice and stop all kinds of bad things that should be stopped. And so in a sense, that's good. But there are other things, other forms of motivation that can fight for justice just as well, maybe better than anger. And so when people justify compulsion like you just did, or justify anger without a clear understanding of equally or perhaps more powerfully motivating forces that humans are possible to touch into, I get a little sad. And because it's just so limited. And if people really understood these other strong motivating forces that where the means doesn't have to justify the ends, but where the means, the end doesn't have to justify the means, but where the means is just so beautiful in itself, then maybe it doesn't matter if we reach the end. Anyway, so I think there's as powerful motivating forces that can produce great human things that don't require compulsion, neurosis, and anger. So, thank you so much. And next week, for those of you who dare to come back, we will flip over completely to the other side of life and talk about ill will. And so if we talk about getting rid of ill will, maybe there won't be as many protests. Or maybe there'll be more. But anyway, we'll have fun hopefully next week looking at how ill will functions as a hindrance. So thank you so much.